Hello, and welcome to The Brief, a podcast that looks at global news events and brings you perspective and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. As always, we do appreciate a like or a follow, and you can find links to more of our episodes at thebriefpodcast.org. Well, the negotiations to advance the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel in Gaza, fraught with danger right now. Even the former U.S. envoy to Israel says Trump's plan of ethnically cleansing Gaza to build a Middle East Riviera isn't serious and isn't going to happen. For the first time in decades, Israel deployed tanks to the West Bank, where Palestinian population centers have been devastated by bombings strikingly similar to what we've witnessed in Gaza. The hostages held by Hamas are hanging in the balance of hope for the families and hard right demands to return to full-scale conflict. Palestinian hostages and prisoners may number in the hundreds, but mainstream news coverage of their plight, their stories as human beings, widely ignored. But there are some broader questions and concerns, especially related to President Donald Trump 2.0 as his second term gets underway. The dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development, the adoption of Russian talking points about the war in Ukraine. Our guest on this edition of The Brief Podcast is none other than Kenneth Roth, the former executive director of Human Rights Watch. Now, he's written about his experiences defending human rights while dealing with some of the world's worst autocrats and dictators. It's all included in his new book, Righting Wrongs, 3 decades on the Front Lines Battling Abusive Governments. Kenneth Roth, hello and welcome to The Brief.
Hi, good to be here, Jim.
You know, there's so many topics to go over. Is there any way we can prioritize what's happening in our world today, the massive changes that we are watching in U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I mean, obviously the U.S. is the big wild card. And we're seeing, you know, huge changes in policy toward Israel with respect to Russia and Ukraine, you know, potentially with respect to China. So, you know, this is the wild card everybody's looking at. And, you know, Trump being Trump, we're actually not sure where he is. This is a, you know, malleable guy. He's very emotional. And he's one place today. He could be another place tomorrow. But I think the challenge is, you know, how do we try to nudge him in a positive direction?
Well, certainly. And I'm going to start here. And that's on Ukraine, the human rights issues that are there. The third anniversary was marked really by President Trump lashing out at President Zelensky of Ukraine, calling him a dictator, saying that he started the war with Russia. People aghast, certainly our allies in Europe, wondering what comes next.
I mean, this is the problem with Trump. And he, at this stage, you know, is just parroting Putin's talking points. And it's never been entirely clear why Trump is so enamored of Putin. He clearly admires Putin's ability to, you know, get things done without any parliament getting in the way, without any media getting in the way. You know, he likes those dictatorial powers. I think the fact that Putin has been around forever, it also, you know, is something that Trump likes and would like to emulate. But I think the real challenge on Ukraine is, you know, certain parameters of a deal are pretty clear. I mean, there's not going to be a lot of pushing back with respect to the territory that Russia's already taken. But the real issue is Ukraine's democracy and Ukraine's sovereignty going forward. And Ukraine is rightfully asking for security guarantees. It doesn't want just a ceasefire, because Putin would use that ceasefire to rearm and then reinvade. So Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, you know, wants some guarantee from European governments plus the United States that they would stand in the way of Putin invading again. And Europe seems quite willing to provide this. Trump may not. But that's giving away the store, because Putin's goal here is to eradicate Ukraine's democracy. He hates the idea of a major Slavic nation on Russia's border being a democratic model that Russians might want to emulate. And so he's determined to wipe out the democracy, to turn Kremlin into a, to turn Ukraine into a Kremlin vassalist state. And the question is, you know, is Putin going to stand up for that? Or is Putin going to be the 21st century Neville Chamberlain and just appease, I mean, Trump just appease Putin? And that's, you know, that's the unknown at this stage.
Well, of course, the Ukrainians weren't even involved in the talks, had no say. This was, U.S. officials meeting with Russian officials, with good graces of Saudi Arabia. And people are looking at it and saying, what's Ukraine supposed to get out of this? Now, one thing that people don't talk about as much, but all of the tens of thousands of prisoners of Ukrainians that are being held in Russia, including children. And that isn't even mentioned. Human rights really haven't been a part of this at all. We've been talking about, mineral wealth and other, quid pro quos.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully any peace deal would include an exchange of prisoners of war, but also the release of the Ukrainian children, whom Putin, not only kidnapped and tried to turn into Russians, but this is the basis of the war crime charges against Putin filed by the International Criminal Court. So this remains a very live issue. And it just underscores the importance of the Ukrainians being at the table, the importance of Trump not just appeasing Putin, not just giving into the Kremlin for, whatever inexplicable reasons of admiration Trump has for Putin. But it requires, a deal that is a just deal and that preserves the rights and the democracy of Ukrainians.
I want to talk about the Middle East, about Gaza. Trump unveiled his plan essentially to ethnically cleanse Gaza. The Palestinians would leave, and perhaps more likely, the Israelis are already saying they would never have the right to come back. And that's a well-worn path towards ethnic cleansing and more international war crimes. What is Trump thinking? Will it work?
No, it won't work. And indeed, it's already pretty much a dead plan. But Trump, is proposing a massive war crime, essentially a crime against humanity. Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention makes absolutely clear that it is a war crime to forcibly expel the population of occupied territory. And Trump, just says whatever and proposes it. Now, Netanyahu would love that. This has legitimized what up until now has been anathema, really unthinkable. But fortunately, Egypt and Jordan, the potential recipients of the Palestinian population, have said, despite the massive U.S. military aid at stake, that they want nothing to do with this. The Saudis and the Emiratis have said, if you want our money to rebuild Gaza, you don't get rid of the Palestinians. We want to see a clear path to a Palestinian state. So the region is pretty united in saying no to Trump. But the danger here is that there traditionally have been three options on the table for Israel in terms of trying to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One is to say, okay, we recognize the settlement enterprise is so far advanced that there is just a one-state reality between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. Let's give everybody equal rights. But of course, Netanyahu doesn't want that because he would lose his Jewish majority. The alternative that Netanyahu prefers is the status quo, endless occupation. But that's increasingly seen as apartheid, which it is. And so that's not really a viable solution either. The real viable solution is a Palestinian state. But Netanyahu says, not over my dead body. And what Trump does now is he comes in with, what had been unthinkable. The solution to the Palestinian problem is get rid of the Palestinians. That is, not going to work in the region, but it just shows how Trump has zero regard for the most basic rules of international law.
Well, and as we look at all of this, it can be said that Netanyahu has tried everything but peace. I mean, he's tried to, there was all the talk about we'll make the occupation more manageable. They'll have some financial improvements and their standard of living will rise. Well, now, encouraged by Trump, I think in some, at least by some measure, we see the settlers and the military moving against the Palestinians on the real territory that they want, and that is the West Bank. And talking about annexation.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the problem. In other words, Gaza is just a precedent for the West Bank. If Netanyahu can get away with expelling 2 million Palestinians from Gaza, the West Bank is next. Everybody sees that. Netanyahu says, I want peace, but what he really wants is just the Palestinians to accept their permanent subordination, to accept that they're going to live forever under apartheid. And that's, a recipe for endless violence, endless rebellion. Nobody wants that. So that's why I do think the only real option is a Palestinian state living side by side with an Israeli state. And yes, you may need security guarantees and the like, but the Palestinians are just never going to accept a permanent subordinate status.
Now, you have just published a new book, Righting Wrongs. That's all of the lessons that you learned in three decades with Human Rights Watch. And you had to play ball with some really, really bad actors.
Well, you know, the real lesson I've drawn from this is that everybody has something that they want from the international community. And if the human rights movement can condition a government's ability to get that on better respect for human rights, we can change the cost-benefit analysis of repression. We can make repression too costly and tilt an abusive government in a positive direction. And that's what the defense of human rights is all about. It's not about, you know, holding hands and saying kumbaya. It's about, you know, figuring out where are the pressure points and how do we, you know, really put our finger on them until a government changes. And the book is filled with examples of this, including the toughest customers out there. I show how we were able to move Putin, how we were able to move Syria's Assad, you know, how China's Xi Jinping has been ultra sensitive to the pressure that we put on him. And so I really try to show that this enterprise of defending human rights is a powerful tool. We need governmental allies. You know, we do it in part through shaming by just exposing this misdeeds that every government prefers to keep hidden. But we also do it by really pushing democratic governments to make part of their foreign policy the defense of human rights. This is not where the U.S. government is today, but fortunately it is where many other governments are.
I know. I mean, right now I'm asking myself, what's an example of this? One of your, if you can share with us, one of your real experiences that surprised perhaps even you.
Well, let me describe, you know, the example that I opened the book up with, which is how we were able to stop Putin from bombing hospitals, schools, marketplaces, apartment buildings in Idlib province in northwestern Syria. And this had been going on for a few years. And we decided, you know, first we documented it. We showed that these war crimes were taking place, that Putin had direct command responsibility. But then the question is, you know, how do you change Putin? And so we decided at this stage, it was really when Trump was in office, so we didn't look to him. But we looked to the German, the French, and the Turkish governments as three governments that Putin cared about. And he cared about his reputation then, you know, more than today, because this was before he had invaded Ukraine. And so I met with, you know, German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I met with French President Emmanuel Macron. I met repeatedly with key officials in Erdogan's government in Turkey. And gradually, and this was a couple of years it took, we were able to get them through a series of meetings with Putin to really twist his arm. And starting in March 2020, the bombing stopped. And it completely stopped for 3 years. It picked up a little bit after that, but essentially it stopped to the end. And this territory, Idlib, is where HTS, the rebel force, came from that then toppled Assad this past December. So this made an enormous difference for the millions of people living in Idlib. They didn't suddenly have to worry about being, you know, killed suddenly from the skies. And it shows that, you know, even a tough customer like Putin cares about his reputation. He cares about his relations with other governments. And we can use that to get him to curtail some of his worst atrocities.
You know, as we look, and you had a career where you had to examine these kinds of human rights abuses, the ones that you talked about, the bombing of hospitals, for instance. Now, this is what we've watched in Gaza. What is the, you know, a lot of people look at it and they say, what the hell can be the point of all of this? This isn't scoring you any, you know, any wins to be hitting hospitals, but it seems like autocratic leaders and militants really do focus in on doctors, individual hospitals, and they try to eliminate them. Why?
Well, I think the reason is that, you know, particularly in war, people need medical care. I mean, it's just obvious. You know, if you're being bombed left and right, you know, your likelihood of getting injured and needing urgent medical care is very high. And so if you aim to harm the civilian population, not just the combatants on the other side, you hit the hospitals. Now, I should note that international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions and their protocols are designed to spare civilians the hazards of war. It is a war crime to target civilians. It is a war crime to hit their hospitals. But that doesn't stop governments from doing it. That's what Assad did in Syria, and that's what Netanyahu did in Gaza. And I think the point is, you know, in Gaza, part collective punishment is partly just blaming all Palestinians for Hamas's horrors on October 7th. But it partly is an aim to fulfill this far-right Israeli dream of getting rid of the Palestinians in Gaza. And if you make Gaza unlivable, and that seems to be what Israel was trying to do with its indiscriminate bombardment, it's this destruction of whole neighborhoods, it's forcing 90% of the population to leave their homes, the aim is ultimately to get them to so-called voluntarily, as one right-wing minister put it, to leave. That's a blatant war crime. It's something the Palestinians have no intention of doing because they understand that this is a one-way exit. You know, like the 1948 Nakba, they'll never be allowed back. But that is the Israeli government's aim here.
And as we look at it, I mean, there has to be some measure of hope that people get. I mean, the doctors, the hospitals, the nurses all embody the best in human beings reaching out and helping. And so long as those people exist, I think that there's a tendency for the population to say there's hope. It really feeds that.
Jim, I think you're absolutely right. And that's why, you know, when we do see hospitals and medical workers targeted, it really is an effort to attack the whole civilian population. You know, this is just screaming at the world, we're committing war crimes here. It's going back to the so-called total war, where you could go after anybody on the other side. But that kind of war was supposed to end with the Geneva Conventions that were adopted after World War II. Some governments, you know, particularly Putin, but also, you know, the Assad government, the Israeli government, are ripping up those rules. And, you know, the good news is the International Criminal Court is intervening. It is trying to uphold those rules. It has charged Putin. It has charged Netanyahu. That is, you know, an important deterrent because nobody wants to spend the rest of their lives running away from an international arrest warrant. But, you know, we do have to recognize that there's always this tendency by governments to rip up the rules. And our job in the human rights community is to make them pay a very severe price when they do that. And we can.
And you, as you mentioned in your, you know, talking about your book, that a lot of that has to do with you've got to set up the documentation of all of this. And what we've watched in Gaza is that the journalists, the people that are documenting what is happening on the ground, not only the journalists, but the journalists and their families have been targeted as well.
Yeah. No, Jimmy, you're absolutely right. I mean, it begins with clear factual documentation. And, you know, that's what the bulk of the Human Rights Watch staff does. The investigators on the staff, we call them researchers, they're based around the world, and they do very intensive, detailed, objective investigations. They document what happened. They publish their findings. And those reports become the basis of pressure to try to change. Now, you know, if you are a government committing abuses, you try to cover them up. And that's why we've seen the Israeli government, you know, essentially try to shut down the leading Palestinian human rights groups by declaring that they're terrorists. You know, what does that mean, terrorists? You know, they're revealing the Israeli crimes. That's why they've gone after journalist after journalist. They've shut down Al Jazeera. They've killed, you know, more journalists than I think anybody else over the last year. So that's, you know, the effort to silence the messenger, which should be a big signal to us that something awful is going on.
Sure. We're watching the Trump administration advance some things that you and I are very familiar with. I cover disaster zones, human disasters, conflicts, and natural disasters as well across Africa and other places. And always there kind of make me proud. I'd see the bags of food that said USAID, a gift from the American people. And you didn't see it from the Soviet Union in the old days. You didn't see it from Russia today. You don't see it from China. You don't see it from, you'll see some from the European Union. But that was just, you know, a star in our array of soft power that the United States has been able to deploy over decades. Now it has been ripped asunder.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, Jim. And I think it's horrible what Trump is doing to USAID. You know, the United States is a rich, rich nation. And the idea that it has no responsibility to help people who are starving, who are facing severe deprivation, I mean, that's just awful. That's not what most Americans stand for. There's another dimension to this, too, though. You know, USAID funds around the world human rights defenders, people who promote democracy, independent journalists, the kinds of people who expose autocrats' misdeeds. And that's why, you know, they're clinking champagne in Moscow and Beijing as Trump shuts this all down. Because suddenly one of the leading funders of these independent voices, these independent abilities to monitor autocratic misconduct, suddenly is disappearing. This is a huge gift to the autocrats of the world.
And the corrupt. Because I know from my experiences that USAID money went into programs that would keep tabs on what some very small nation politicians were up to, you know, as they made deals and trades. I mean, highly corrupt. Sometimes U.S. or international companies were involved. Now President Trump has rolled back the Corrupt Foreign Practices Act, which makes bribery legal. So, oh, this is going to, you know, level the playing field. We'll get much better deals. Well, the guy who's, you know, wrote The Art of the Deal doesn't seem to understand much about how what a negative effect that has, not only on all these smaller countries where the corruption is being used, but also on the United States itself and our own corporations.
Yeah. You're right about that, Jim. I mean, what's interesting is U.S. corporations. You know, Trump says, oh, you'll get better deals if you don't have to worry about, you know, being criminally charged for paying a bribe. They're saying, no, we don't want that because now officials around
raises the price.
They're going to ask for bribes. You know, we used to be able to say, no, we can't do that. It's illegal. Now Trump is saying, go for it. You know, so suddenly all these companies are going to have to start paying abroad. Now, the disappearance of the journalists because of Trump's cuts to USAID is making that kind of corruption much easier. And it's interesting to contrast that with, you know, China's approach, because you talked about, you know, how does China aid? Well, China pushes forward these deliberately non-transparent deals. They will go to the head of a government and say, okay, we'll, you know, lend you all this money, but no spotlight here, no publicity. And essentially what they're doing is saying, take your 20% cut. You know, we're fine with that. That'll make you more loyal to us. We're not going to tell anybody. And so this, you know, things like Xi Jinping's $1 trillion Belt and Road Initiative, you know, masquerades as an infrastructure development program, but it's really one huge bribery scheme to buy allies for China as it tries to fend off things like United Nations scrutiny of its if its atrocities against the Uyghurs, for example, in Xinjiang.
You know, I look at USAID and I look at the farmers in the U.S. who have benefited from it. The U.S. has a surplus of grain that it produces every year. And the notion is our farmers can benefit. We pay them for this grain and then we can ship it abroad and help out people that are in real dire need. And not even to mention the medical programs, the AIDS programs, you know, the population control programs, all those kinds of things that USAID has been funding. Who takes their place? What takes their place? I don't think private donors are anywhere close to being able to pick that up.
No, I mean, that's completely true. I mean, even a, you know, a huge donor like the Gates Foundation just gives a tiny fraction of what the U.S. government does with respect to, you know, emergency medical care or, you know, AIDS treatment or the various, you know, very important efforts to vaccinate and fight infectious diseases around the world. If the U.S. backs out, we're all in much greater danger because these infectious diseases will flourish. And, you know, they don't respect borders. You know, Trump can beef up the border, but that's not going to stop germs from getting in. And so, you know, we're all going to be at risk. You mentioned the farmers. You know, these are red state farmers where suddenly one of their huge purchasers of grain is disappearing. Guess what that's going to do to prices? They're going to drop. You know, the farmers are not going to be happier. So, you know, this is just Trump with his, you know, absurd America First view of things, which is callous, but also, you know, doesn't look past first base. It doesn't look at the longer term consequences, many of which are going to hurt Americans.
Project 2025, you know, it appears that they spent 4 years writing all of this stuff up. And I must say, after just a month of it, I'm looking at it and, you know, one side says, oh, this is just so much dramatic change. And from the Oval Office, there was a Freudian slip. There's pronouncements that we have uncovered billions in corruption. But the fact of the matter is they're lying. They haven't uncovered that much corruption. It wasn't in USAID. He has smeared that program as being filled with fraud and corruption. I didn't witness it Across 40 years of covering that program out in the field, I didn't witness any of it. And yet we are at this place that, I mean, it's sad. And I don't know how we rebuild that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jimmy, you're right. This is Trump's classic tactic of stating the big lie, stating it over and over, and figuring if you repeat it enough, people will believe it. So if he says he found fraud, you know, he doesn't put forward the evidence. He just says it. Elon Musk claims to have found all these savings. He just adds on zeros. You know, that's what has now been revealed. You know, he's concocting all of this. But, you know, the real danger behind this Project 2025 endeavor is that Trump is deliberately undermining the checks and balances on his authority. That's a classic autocrat's move. So he's going after the inspector generals. He's going after the independent voices in the various agencies. He has, you know, essentially silenced the Republican senators, which is amazing, you know, because these people have the capacity to fight back, but they're also terrified of a primary challenge that they're willing to sacrifice the national interest in the name of just staying in power, you know, getting their seat, getting reelected. So, you know, Trump has been very good at just silencing a lot of these key checks, which is why the independent media remains so important. I hope the Democrats find their voice. They haven't really so far. But we need to, you know, to fight to preserve checks and balances, because otherwise, you know, we know where that leads. It leads to Viktor Orban in Hungary. It leads to Erdogan in Turkey. You know, we've seen how this plays out. And it would be a disaster if the United States moves in that direction. Trump is trying to take the country in that direction. We need to fight back.
Well, one of the things that's most disturbing to me is, you know, the U.S. sponsored human rights episodes in all of its military training. It brought people in specifically to look at what are the rights of civilians in conflict and how far can you go? And every single officer was required to see all of that. Now, the attorneys that and those who would enforce those kinds of rules, those who would hold that standard up, they're being eliminated wholesale. And it's not something you easily, you know, you can take it apart in a month, but you can't put it together, not even in years.
Yeah. No, Jim, you're onto something here. Pete Hegseth, the new defense secretary, already, you know, before his nomination, was a big proponent of soldiers who had been charged and convicted of war crimes. He wanted them pardoned and forgiven. He now, you know, amazingly has been confirmed as secretary. And one of the first things he does is fire the lead military lawyers who were responsible for enforcing the Geneva Conventions. And he basically says, oh, I want, you know, more of a warrior mentality. You know, what he means is I want freer license to kill civilians because, you know, that's what the Geneva Conventions prevent. And that is, you know, a stupid view of what it takes to win wars, because we've seen that when the U.S. government is inattentive to the welfare of civilians, when they just fire away and don't really care about the large civilian toll, you get the enormous pushback that you got in Afghanistan, where they just, you know, reaffirmed the Taliban, which ended up taking over the country. You get the pushback we found in Iraq, and it led to the emergence of the Islamic State. You know, it's why when Netanyahu follows that same strategy, it reaffirms Hamas. It doesn't defeat Hamas. I mean, they still are far from defeated. So, you know, the smart generals know that respecting the Geneva Conventions is a better way, a more effective way to fight a war. But, you know, Hegseth comes in and sees this only as a restraint on the warrior mentality that he wants to promote. He basically is saying, go commit war crimes. You've got my license. This is, you know, basically going to be evidence against him for commander-in-chief responsibility when these war crimes are committed. But it also is a disaster for the United States, because if it starts fighting like that, it's going to bolster the enemy, not defeat it.
Well, you know, I still hold out some hope. I know a lot of general officers, and I've talked with the admirals, and there is a shared belief in what you just said, that if you fight a war by the rules, if you follow those rules that protect civilians, your chances of success in winning hearts and minds, whatever is necessary, is expanded. It's increased tenfold. And they don't want to give that up. They feel that that's an important part of the military order.
I mean, absolutely. And, you know, there's this tendency to think of the Geneva Conventions as, you know, some concoction of human rights groups. That's completely untrue. It was written by the militaries of the world. You know, this was the leading military commanders who got together and said, this is the smart, the better way to fight wars. Let's codify this. Let's all agree to abide by these standards. And, you know, here we are, what, 60 years later, and Hegseth comes in knowing nothing about actually fighting wars and wants to rip that up. You know, go back to the total war where you bomb civilians left and right. You know, that never turns out well, obviously for the civilians, but it doesn't turn out well for the attacking military as well. But Hegseth is just, you know, oblivious to all that.
What would you tell, I mean, that Mr. Trump's supporters, others, they want to change in the United States, but help them understand, why is the core of human rights so fundamental to the United States of America?
Well, I mean, or you could say the same, why is democracy so fundamental to the United States of America? I mean, you know, Trump relishes breaking norms, breaching taboos, but, you know, this is a guy who, in his heart of hearts, wants to be a dictator. So, you know, we already know he was, you know, unwilling to respect an election that he lost. He is now actively underwriting severe human rights abuses abroad. If he starts committing those in the United States, he wants to be able to do it with impunity because he's attacking the various institutions that might have, you know, challenged him. You know, he's put his little cronies in charge of the Justice Department, of the FBI. You know, these are people who are not terribly qualified. They know that they were put forward only because Trump favored them. So they're the last people who are going to exert any independent authority. Trump is setting it up so he can get away with whatever he wants to do, including severe human rights violations.
Those are all warning signs. And I think there's a lot of people in the United States, in Europe and around the world that are looking on and they say, well, what are we supposed to do about this? What's my role in this? You said the Democratic leadership hasn't, you know, in this party, the other major political party. Let's remember that Donald Trump doesn't have a huge mandate that he's carrying forward here. He got a bare election win. It was a win, but at the same time, the entire country isn't in favor of all of this. And it would look from the polls that fewer and fewer of them are. But how can individuals speak up or make their voice heard?
Well, I mean, in the United States, you know, fortunately, we still have an independent media. So that plays a very important role. Individuals have social media. And, you know, even though Elon Musk's, you know, latest musings rise to the top of your Twitter or X feed annoyingly, you know, these are still important platforms. You know, we know that people tend to trust their friends and their family more than distant institutions. And so I think the more people speak for the truth, the more people speak for the principles of democracy and human rights, that is a, you know, a message that we'll carry. But each of us has a responsibility to do that. It's not enough to just sort of hope that others will pick up the cry. This is something that requires the defense of all of us.
I think it requires us to become engaged more than we have been, to become informed better than we have been in the past. I'm a little bit alarmed. I don't know whether you share my feelings on this, but the mainstream media and the self-censorship on issues like Gaza, it is pretty startling. I mean, rightly, we're covering the Israeli hostages as they come out in this tentative and very fragile ceasefire that's there right now. But Palestinians, it seems like less and less are they being regarded as human beings, and the media is afraid to point that out, to stand up and say, well, what is their story? What is their part in all of this? And that kind of self-censorship comes from pressure groups. And I don't think they're standing up to it very well. Maybe you disagree.
No, I agree with you, Jim. There, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is how there is no government any place in the world that has a more organized group of backers than the Israeli government. And, you know, I faced this when I was running Human Rights Watch. Anytime you criticize Israel, you just expect to be lambasted by these groups that think Israel never does anything wrong and it's always the other side's fault. And, you know, I learned how to resist that just by making sure that all the Human Rights Watch reports on Israel and Palestine were 100% factually accurate, 100% principled, applying the same standards there as we do every place else. So we weathered the storm. But, you know, I mean, I was repeatedly accused of being an anti-Semite. You know, this, I'm Jewish. You know, my father fled the Nazis. I got into human rights by hearing my father tell, you know, Hitler stories as I was growing up. You know, I was very aware of the evil that governments could do, and I was determined to try to fight that wherever it happened. But I was not going to create an Israel exception. And but, you know, to be called anti-Semitic because I'm willing to fairly and accurately criticize Israel is to cheapen the concept of anti-Semitism at a point where Jews around the world really do face a threat from anti-Semitism. But if people begin to think that charges of anti-Semitism are just a, you know, a cheap excuse to defend Israel, that is going to undermine the defense against anti-Semitism that we really urgently need.
Strong words, important words, Kenneth Roth. He's got a new book out called Righting Wrongs, Lessons from Three Decades at the Helm of Human Rights Watch. Ken, so great to have you with us. Thanks again.
I enjoyed our chat. Thanks very much, Jim.
And thank you for joining us. Please explore many of our other episodes of The Brief Podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Give us a like or subscribe. For a complete listing, you can find more information at thebriefpodcast.org. For now, I'm Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.